Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. As you may be aware, false beliefs die slowly. In 1494, in a handbook on witch hunting, two Dominican friars said that you identified witches by the presence of seizures. Over 100,000 women were thought to have been killed as they thought they were witches. Even as late as 1900, several states in the United States made it illegal to marry if you had epilepsy. What are the myths that still exist about seizures and epilepsy? Our phone numbers are 550-8422 in Anchorage. Outside Anchorage, our toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255. Our email address is line1@aprn.org. Coming up next hour, we'll be discussing seizures and epilepsy on Line 1, your health connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by The Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. And by Providence Imaging Center, providing Alaska women complete breast imaging services since 1986, including radiologists who specialize in breast imaging 5 days a week. Information online at provimaging.com.
Welcome to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic, as we said earlier, is seizures and epilepsy. Our phone numbers for questions and comments should be common to you if you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska. In Anchorage, that number is 550-8422, the toll-free number 1-800-478-8255, and you can email us during the program at Line One, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at aprn.org. Today's guest is a Wasilla neurologist, Dr. Jeffrey Sponsler. And before we get started, I want to just mention next week's guest will be Anchorage urologist, Dr. Wesley Turner, and we'll be talking about and answering your questions on kidney stones and bladder cancer. Dr. Sponsler, welcome to Line One.
Thank you very much, Dr. Woodard. I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you.
Good. Tell us a little bit about your training and then how you got here and what you're doing up in the valley right now.
Thank you for asking. I am currently solo neurologist in Matsu Valley, and I'm associated with Matsu Regional Medical Center, where I have attending privileges and consulting privileges. Medicine's a second career. I started out in engineering, got a degree in computer science, worked for NASA on the Hubble Space Telescope for about 7 years, and then proceeded to move forward educationally, went to medical school, found an interesting correlation between engineering, software engineering, and the human brain, and was naturally drawn to the field of brain medicine or neurology. I have some family members that had or have some neurological illnesses. I think that was a factor. And once about halfway through my neurology training, and that was at West Virginia University School of Medicine. I am from West Virginia. I really got a real attraction to the field of epilepsy through one of my professors who, interestingly, was from Eastern Europe and had herself been transplanted to West Virginia. And so after completing neurology training, I did a fellowship. Technically, the fellowship is one that is called clinical neurophysiology with training in EEG, which is electroencephalogram reading, EMG, which is electromyographic interpretation, and the focus of the fellowship was on epilepsy with kind of a minor in neuromuscular disorders.
So for me, it doesn't seem that far of a stretch to jump from computers to neurology. I guess one of the first thoughts I had in my mind as you were describing where you came from and how you've got here is that we often use the analogy of the brain like a computer and talk about hardwiring and so forth. Is that a fair kind of analogy to make?
The analogy, I thought, was fairly high quality. However, there are really some important similarities and some important differences. For one thing, the human brain or the mammalian brain is very, very old, almost on geological time scale. So it's been around for a long time. Nature's been fine-tuning this system for millions of years. The architecture of the digital computer is one that has been around for less than 100 years. And it's very good at crunching numbers. It's very good at storing large amounts of data and doing computations quickly. Digital computers are not very good. In fact, it's reasonable to make the case that they do not actually do what we would call thinking. My field in computer science before I went to medical school was called artificial intelligence, which is the attempt to write computer programs which emulate the thinking processes, the artificial behaviors, or the intelligent behaviors of humans. And there's been some success in that. There are expert systems far and wide. When you are typing a paper using Microsoft Word will often give you some grammar suggestions, certainly does spell checking. The grammar suggestions are clearly being computed by an artificially intelligent program behind the scenes, interestingly enough. But my point there is that the concept of awareness or consciousness is not been, that I'm aware of, emulated by computers, and therein lies the biggest point. And that issue of awareness or consciousness is important insofar as the mind-body problem and so on and so forth. I have no training in philosophy and I have no training in religion, so I don't have a great deal more to say about the mind-body problem.
Yeah, I don't want to get into consciousness and all that. We got enough just to try to discuss and help people understand epilepsy and seizures and their options. But it would make interesting talk off the air. Well, if we're going to talk about and help our listening audience understand seizures a little bit, I'd like to ask you to just – I know it's extremely difficult in a radio context, but give us some overview of the important anatomy and workings of the brain, and particularly even down on the nerve level as we begin to maybe drill down to understand what's going on with seizures. So go at it here and see what you can do.
Thank you. The brain is remarkably complicated at all levels. The complexity can be seen at the microscopic level, and the complexity is there at the gross level. And I hesitated when I was getting ready for this radio show to speak a lot about the sort of microscopic level, but I think there are some concepts that are worth speaking about, especially in the context of diagnosis and treatment of the disorder epilepsy. At the basement level of the mammalian central nervous system is the nerve cell that has been called the neuron. And the neuron can be thought of as a small adding machine or subtracting machine. It's a little tiny calculator. To call it a computer is probably not quite right. And the reason for that is the neuron takes inputs and it produces outputs. It's like a mathematical function. The structure of the neuron really can be divided into three pieces. The cell body, and anyone that's had high school biology knows that the cell is the smallest unit of the living organism, and the cell has the nucleus, which contains DNA, and the cell has the metabolic machinery, mitochondria. It's the part of the cell that keeps the other parts of the cell alive and functioning. It's a little metabolic machinery. The neuron has a receiving or an input processing structure called dendrite or dendrites. And if you see the dendrite under a microscope, it looks like a little tree with no leaves. And the dendrites receive information, and they receive that information mostly from other neurons that are quote-unquote talking to that neuron. The output part of the neuron is called the axon, A-X-O-N. An axon is usually a long, very thin structure that extends out away from the cell body, and it may go a few millimeters, it may go a few inches or even feet away from that cell body. And the axon is the output part. If the cell body is this little adding machine and it's receiving information from the dendrites, it's going to add them up. And occasionally, if the inputs that come in add up just right, and I'll speak a bit more about that in a minute, then the cell will trigger something we call an action potential, which is an electrically important physiological event. And that action potential, if we move back to the world of computers, is a lot like a bit. That bit of information will travel down the axon, and at the other end, that bit of information will go and be received by another neuron. Now, back to this adding machine concept of the neuron. Neurons receive excitatory inputs, and they receive inhibitory inputs. The excitatory inputs tend to depolarize the inside of the neuron. They make it more negative. The neuron can be thought of as a little battery where the inside is negative and the outside is positive. So the depolarizing excitatory inputs make the inside a little less negative. The inhibitory inputs make the interior of the cell a little more the excitatory inputs make the interior a little more positive, and the inhibitory inputs make the interior of the cell a little more negative. So if you have two inputs to one cell at the same time, one excitatory and the other inhibitory, they balance out. The cell will sit there in its resting state and not do anything. However, if you have a large amount of excitatory inputs to that cell and only few inhibitory inputs, then the cell, as an adding machine, will the interior will become more positive, reach a threshold, and produce an action potential, which, as I said, is a bit of information which is then discharged from that cell. And that is sort of the basic workings of the neuron. Complicated, but individually quite simple. Now, the next level of this is just the sheer magnitude of neurons. And the number of neurons in the human brain is measured in hundreds of billions. Mm-hmm. That's a very large number. The next concept that I wanted to address briefly in terms of the neuron in the greater context of our discussion about epilepsy is that the neuron is excitable tissue. It acts like a little charged battery, and how it maintains that charge is the flow and movement of various ions. Now, on your kitchen table, you have table salt. Salt is sodium chloride. Sodium and chloride are the essential ingredients in the behavior of nerve cells and muscle cells, any excitable tissue in the body. And so the interior of the cell is maintained by pumping sodium out and potassium in. So these pumps are very important. And similarly, this action potential, which I mentioned earlier, the action potential is triggered by the opening of sodium channels. So sodium will rapidly flood into the interior of the cell. As I mentioned, the interior is usually is negative, and so the flow of sodium across the membrane depolarizes that cell, but it's rapidly repolarized with the inside being negative and the outside being positive. Now, the next level that I wanted to discuss was the gross level of the brain, And if you look at the brain in a picture book or an anatomy textbook, what you will see is lobes, and the lobes are defined to some degree by their location, but also by their structure. The frontal lobes are in the front. The frontal lobe, the left frontal lobe contains the left motor cortex. The left motor cortex will allow the brain to control the right side of the body. The motor cortex is named motor because it affects motion by the movement of muscle activity. So now, for the next part of the discussion, I'd like to fuse the microscopic and the macroscopic to some degree. The left motor cortex allows you to move your thumb. So let's look at this microscopically. The axon that is in your left motor cortex has the neuron of the left motor cortex has a long axon. That axon projects all the way through your brain, down through your spinal cord to in your neck, the a part of the spinal cord that is called the ventral horn. And in the ventral horn, there is another neuron, which is called an alpha motor neuron. And that neuron projects an axon out to, for example, the muscles at the base of your thumb. So it's a two-cell system for your mind to command your thumb to move. Now, in the context of an epilepsy disorder, we can take a simple example. Let's say that a person is 80 years old and develops a tumor in the left motor cortex. That tumor irritates the brain tissue and those brain cells in that region of the left motor cortex and might cause those brain cells to produce abnormal electrical signals, which will pass all the way through this two neuron system that I mentioned and make the thumb move. That would be a partial seizure.
So this, in a sense, what you're saying is that perturbations, abnormalities in the conduction of these neurons is really where the action starts that causes seizures. And the kinds of activity we see in the body as a result of that depends on the variability in these action changes in action potentials and the location of where this is happening for at least two examples of what I might think of that may affect how seizures are manifest.
That's reasonable. I'd like to take a minute to mention, as a practitioner of medicine, epilepsy is in some ways it can be a benign disorder. In some ways, it can be a tragic, heartbreaking disorder. Famous people with epilepsy I'd like to touch on briefly. And the reason for this is that other diseases have their spokespersons. Mm-hmm. And for example, Michael J. Fox seems to be the poster child for Parkinson's disease. Famous people that we know about that have or have had epilepsy include Julius Caesar. He may be the most famous. Vladimir Lenin of Lenin and Marx, communism. Hugo Weaving, who is the actor who was in Lord of the Rings and the Matrix movies. Danny Glover, the actor. Neil Young, the musician. Lindsey Buckingham of Fleetwood Mac. And Edgar Allan Poe, although Poe's epilepsy disorder may have had more to do with alcohol withdrawal.
So it just because you have a seizure doesn't mean it's lifelong, doesn't mean it's particularly needs to be treated all the time, and it doesn't necessarily have a terribly bad prognosis with it. It's just there's a lot of misunderstanding because we don't many of the public don't understand the complexity of the differences in epilepsy. Is that what you're saying?
The disorder is not that uncommon. The estimates are perhaps 0.5% may have a seizure in any given year. This is United States population medical statistics. For the state of Alaska, that 0.5% based on our population may represent 3,400 patients, maybe as high as 6,800 patients may have the disorder epilepsy. The disorder seems to occur more often in the very young and the elderly. And this is a bimodal incidence, and it's based on the fact that very young children or infants may be born with abnormalities of brain that can predispose them to a seizure disorder. The elderly will be commonly afflicted by the disorders of the elderly, such as Alzheimer's disease, strokes, brain tumors, and these are disorders that can be triggering in terms of epilepsy. Overall, the picture for the treatment of epilepsy is good. About 65% of patients with epilepsy can be made seizure-free on the first or second medication. That is to say, they take their medication two times per day or once per day, they'll have no more seizures. They can go on about their life. They have the slight increased complexity on a daily basis of having to take a pill and to maintain a relationship with their physician or their neurologist, but they can otherwise do very well. 25, 30, 35% of patients with the disorder of seizures or epilepsy, and we want to discuss the differences between those two words shortly in our program, I'm sure. About 30 to 35% are medically intractable. That means that it doesn't matter what medication the doctor gives them, they are not seizure-free. And they represent the number of the group of people that I consider heartbreaking, the ones that where it's more of a tragic illness. That is to say, they have more seizures. There's no cure. The medications don't work that well, and they have a much more complicated time. They can't drive. They have trouble getting and keeping a job. They have trouble going to school and studying, and so it's a harder, more difficult medical illness for them.
We have an email that I want to get to, which asks a specific question about a patient with a seizure disorder. But before we go there, let's go ahead and make sure we do address the difference between the term seizure and epilepsy.
Good. And I do welcome emails and telephone calls, and hopefully we can try to answer those questions as they come in. The question, what is meant by the disorder epilepsy? I've tried to provide some physiological and some anatomical bases for the disorder, but I went to Merritt's textbook of neurology, and this is what he says about epilepsy, or the textbook says, epilepsy is a temporary physiological dysfunction of the brain caused by a self-limited abnormal hypersynchronous electrical discharge of cortical neurons. Somewhat esoteric, somewhat hard to understand for the neurologist or for the physician involved in taking care of such cases. Hypersynchronous electrical discharge is probably the important thing. We'll talk about EEGs here later in your program, I'm sure. But the EEG shows us brain waves. The electroencephalogram shows us brain waves. And when an EEG is being read by a neurologist, the brain waves typically tend to look a little bit chaotic and asynchronous. Asynchronous meaning they're not all working exactly in lockstep at the same time. They're all quasi-autonomous, talking to each other, but there's not synchronous electrical behavior. In a seizure, we see hypersynchronous electrical behavior, that a large group of brain cells are discharging electrically at the same time in lockstep. And that's abnormal, and that's what causes a seizure. So let's take a minute to try to answer your question more specifically. And the way that I like to explain the difference between seizure and epilepsy, those terms, is as follows. A seizure is a symptom of an underlying brain disorder. If we are resident in the emergency department, and I, I realize as a pediatrician, you've been in the emergency department many times, and you've probably definitely, as a pediatrician, seen seizures. The patient appears greatly in distress. They may appear unresponsive. They may not be able to talk to you or answer questions. They may lose consciousness, fall down to the floor, and they may move their body abnormally. All of these are very frightful things to observe. They're frightening things for the patient to experience, and their family members and friends are certainly struck by this profound change in the person's behavior. That's a seizure, and it is the external symptom of something that's going on inside the patient's brain. Epilepsy, as a term, represents a syndrome of abnormal brain activity. And I'm going to articulate a few items about epilepsy later, but for now, I wanted to go through a checklist of seizures. And to go back to this idea of an analogy of a seizure as the external manifestation or a symptom of an epilepsy disorder, let's take, for example, a fever. If somebody has influenza, they may have a fever. So just like if I have influenza, I may have a fever. The fever is a symptom of influenza. The seizure may be a symptom of an underlying brain disorder. We divide seizures into two broad categories: non-epileptic versus epileptic seizures. Now, non-epileptic, as the term suggests, represents the fact that these are not caused by epilepsy. These are seizures that are caused by something else. Number one, we have the term provoked seizure. Provoked as in produced by something. And let me take time to give you a few examples. If a person has, for various reasons, low sodium, low salt, that ion that I mentioned earlier, which is so critical to the neuron's activity and the production of action potentials, if the sodium is too low, that is abnormal. The brain, it becomes irritable with low sodium, and that can produce a seizure. This would not be epilepsy. This would be a hyponatremic seizure. Number two, the consumption of alcoholic beverages does not in and of itself produce seizures. In fact, alcohol as a substance works at the microscopic neuronal level at something we call the GABA receptor. Someone that is has alcoholism and consumes too much alcohol, let's say a fifth of whiskey a day, they are consuming this medication, which really is something of a medication. It goes into the brain and it acts at these GABA receptors. GABA is gamma aminobutyric acid. The GABA receptor is one of these parts of the neuron system that's inhibitory. That is to say, it calms nerve cells down. Anyone that's had alcohol knows that there is, among other effects, euphoria and so on, a calming effect to alcohol. So a person that's consuming large amounts of alcohol is suppressing via GABA receptors large parts of their brain every time they have high levels of alcohol. If that person were to suddenly stop alcohol, that suppression of the entire brain would stop. They would have, I can't say absolutely, but they might have a seizure. That would be a withdrawal seizure. That's another example of a provoked seizure. Number three, we have medications that we use as practicing physicians and nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. One of these, and in preparing for this talk, I debated inside my own mind whether to bring this up because it can really be a Pandora's box of trouble for doctors and nurse practitioners out there. But I'll mention one drug, tramadol. which is also called Altram. Altram has listed that it lowers seizure threshold and can be a trigger for seizures. Now, this does not mean that tramadol is going to cause you to have a seizure. I use tramadol. It's actually a good pain reliever. It does, however, have this slight risk. And in general, a seizure patient, somebody with epilepsy, would not want to take tramadol. Taking tramadol, if you've never had a seizure before and you have a seizure, that would be a provoked seizure. Finally, under this broad general class of non-epileptic seizures, we have the term pseudo-seizure. And this term comes with quite a bit of controversy and confusion on the part of the public, I think. The statistic is of emergency department admissions for seizures, the number of patients coming into an emergency department with a pseudo-seizure may be as high as 30%. That is, 3 out of 10 ER visits for seizure may be pseudo-seizure. Pseudo-seizure is our term for a psychological or behavioral seizure. That is to say, there is an underlying brain disorder that's causing the seizure that is not epilepsy. The risk factors for pseudo-seizures include childhood abuse, post-traumatic stress disorder. We have a term, conversion disorder, which is a psychiatric diagnosis, and seizures are not uncommonly the external symptom or manifestation of a conversion disorder. Now, shifting my attention briefly to further categorization of seizures. And neurologists have spent the better part of 150 years categorizing and recategorizing seizures. The French physicians have they jumped in there early with the naming, and so we have terms like grand mal. We've renamed that generalized tonic-clonic seizure. The French also came up with the term petit mal, which means little and terrible. We've reclassified those with another French term, absence seizure. Additionally, neurologists have come up with this classification scheme. Simple partial seizures are seizures where we have abnormal motor activity of hand or an arm abnormally moving, but consciousness is not impaired in a simple partial seizure. Complex partial seizure is the term we use where it's a simple partial seizure with some extra changes, specifically that awareness or consciousness is impaired. Now, that may be that the patient is talking and suddenly they have speech arrest. They cannot make speech, which is a slight impairment of those speech centers. But there may be complete loss of consciousness. In either case, that's a complex partial seizure. And the older term for that was psychomotor seizure or temporal lobe seizure. And the reason that we use those terms is because it's believed physiologically these seizures emanate or begin in the temporal lobes. Back to my gross anatomy discussion, the temporal lobes are like by the temples, by the ears, they process hearing information, sound. The temporal lobes, especially the left temporal lobe, is where language and memory tend to be predominantly processed. Interestingly, the anatomy of the temporal lobe, especially for doctors and patients with epilepsy, is something we call the hippocampus. And if you have a low-power microscope, you can see the hippocampus. We can see them in MRIs. You actually really don't need a microscope to see the hippocampus. It's an S-shaped structure, and it's shaped like a seahorse, hence the term hippocampus, which I suppose is Greek or Latin for seahorse. The hippocampus is unique in its behavior with respect to memory. All day long, each of us is going about our day-to-day activities of school or work, and then there's a great deal of sort of useless information that we perceive during the course of the day, having lunch, going to the bathroom, other things. At night, while you sleep, the hippocampus is busy sorting out important memories from unimportant memories, deleting the unimportant memories and storing or consolidating the important memories. So that is sort of a quick rundown of the temporal lobe and one of my favorite structures, the hippocampus, in light of the disorder that we call complex partial seizures. The hippocampus is part of the brain's superstructure we call the limbic system, and if the limbic system is involved in a seizure, then that's where we lose consciousness. Finally, we have another syndrome that's called a seizure type that's called partial seizures with secondary generalization. And this is a complex partial seizure. There may be some motor activity. There may be some alteration of consciousness. But the seizure evolves into one of these, quote, grand mal type seizures, a convulsion where the patient is in extraordinary distress. The next very large class of seizures are called generalized seizures. And those include absence-type seizures, which used to be called petit mals, myoclonic seizures where a person may have body jerking, and then there are some other subclassifications there.
Okay. Well, what I want to do now is just take a brief break. We need to do this, and then we'll come back. I've got this email I want to address specifically about seizures. So I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you've got questions or comments, you can reach us at 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. Our email address, line1@aprn.org. After this short break, we'll continue to take any calls or emails and discuss seizures with Dr. Jeffrey Sponsler on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guest today is Wasilla neurologist Dr. Jeffrey Sponsler. If you're listening, we're talking about epilepsy. We've gone through a little bit of the anatomy and some of the different disorders and differences between seizures and epilepsy, and we'd be more than happy to answer any specific questions. So give us a call at 550-8422. Also, you can call us on our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And also remember, if you're listening after 8 o'clock on the program, it was recorded earlier and you're listening to a tape rebroadcast. Also, our email address is line1@aprn.org. Dr. Sponsler, we had an email, and this is from someone who says her sister had meningitis as an infant. Then later, this individual in her 30s started having tics and visions, end quote, and eventually developed some horrible seizures. After 14 years of this, she was finally diagnosed with epilepsy. The medications are working. The question is, could spinal meningitis in infancy, been the cause of this epilepsy? No one else in the family has any seizure problems.
Well, the short answer is yes. Meningitis is an infection of the covering of the brain. We call these meninges. They're kind of a skin. There's the dura mater, the arachnoid mater, and the pia mater, and they cover the outside of the skin, and they can be infected with viruses, sometimes the adenovirus, which is the cold virus. Sometimes they can be infected by bacteria, which is a more devastating type of infection, the reaction of the brain or the reaction of the body's immune system to an infection, especially a bacterial infection, can produce localized tissue changes, scarring. We call that gliosis. And any gliosis or any scarring of the brain tissue, especially the cortex, can cause that cortex to become, we use the term, irritable. That is, it's not going to function electrically in an appropriate manner, and that can be a seizure focus. And I'm glad to hear that the caller's sister is well-controlled with seizure medications, and I hope to briefly discuss the seizure medications. We've had something of a revolution in anti-seizure medications in the past 20 years. I wanted to take a minute to, especially in light of the caller's question, alert patients that have seizures to the relationship that they should have with their internal medicine doctor, their family doctor, and hopefully a neurologist in diagnosing and appropriately treating these types of disorders. The manner in which we diagnose epilepsy in the emergency department or in the clinic is as follows. Number one, we need historic information, and witnesses can do a good job with this. They can help us. They can see whether the head turned to the right. That's important. They can see whether the patient's eyes deviated to the left or the right. That's important. Whether consciousness was altered, whether the patient had jerking movements otherwise, and how long the seizure lasted, whether there was bladder incontinence or whether the patient bit their tongue. Number two, in the clinic, the physician, the emergency department physician or the neurologist will examine the patient and look for signs, subtle or not so subtle, of any abnormalities of the brain and spinal cord. Laboratory studies are important. As I mentioned earlier, sodium is a critical ion in the behavior of the brain and its neurons. Sodium levels have to be checked. Magnesium is another important ion. Potassium. Sodium and magnesium are really very important. Calcium as well. Calcium is used by the nerve cells in a crucial function, which is the release of neurotransmitters, which I briefly earlier discussed, the neurotransmitter called gamma-aminobutyric acid, or GABA. A neurology consult I highly recommend if there's a seizure has occurred, and that can usually be done in a fast manner by a quick call to the neurologist. The neurologist typically will perform an outpatient EEG study, and that's electroencephalogram. Interestingly enough, the brain is an electrical machine, but the voltages are all very small of these electrical discharges. And some of that voltage can actually leak through the spinal fluid, the skull, and the scalp and be picked up by little electrodes that are attached to the surface of the brain. And then these signals, which are really in the measured in microvolts or millionths of a volt, are amplified and run through a digital computer and can be analyzed. So the EEG really is a crucial test for the epilepsy case. The next number of a test that a doctor may order is the MRI. And the MRI is done to look for example, a brain tumor or any scarring that might have occurred if there was an infection. In some patients that have had strokes, we would look for a stroke that might be adversely affecting cortical tissue. Additionally, rarely there are genetic syndromes where the neurons migrate, but they migrate in such a way that they don't complete their journey to the surface of the brain, into the cortex. These are migrational disorders, and they manifest as something that we call cortical dysplasia. And those abnormal, they're really lost nerve cells, and they produce abnormal electrical behaviors that can cause seizures. The term that I mentioned earlier, which is provoked versus unprovoked seizures, if a neurologist sees two unprovoked seizures, then he is, based on our guidelines from the American Academy of Neurology, able to diagnose, make that diagnosis of epilepsy. If the seizure is provoked by the various mechanisms that I mentioned earlier, then we would be reluctant to make the diagnosis of epilepsy. We'd say, oh, you had a provoked seizure from this reason or that. Another rule we have, if there's an unprovoked seizure and the EEG is abnormal, then we are our rules allow us to diagnose the disorder epilepsy. And an abnormal EEG for us shows something called epileptiform discharges, or more simply, a term called spike. And a spike is called a spike because it looks like a spike. It's a sharp little point on the EEG. And sometimes they're followed by something called a slow wave, spike and slow wave, and that's another one of our key waveforms that we look for. And finally, if there's one unprovoked seizure and the brain images by MRI are not normal, then we can generally use that rule to diagnose the disorder epilepsy.
We have another question, and we also have a caller, but since we're down, getting closer to about 10, 12 minutes to go or so, why don't you give us a little bit of overview of the important aspects of medication and treatment, and if you want to, you can talk about how you're doing things a little differently, what you all have to offer in the Valley as far as EEGs than what can be even obtained here in Anchorage, and then we'll see what we've got left over for the questions.
Very good. Thank you. I would like to flip the questions and save the medication question for second, and primarily now draw the attention of the listener to a test that we call video EEG. In my epilepsy fellowship, I basically managed 6 days a week an epilepsy monitoring unit at the place of my training, which was Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. As a neurology resident at West Virginia University, where there is a very robust epilepsy diagnosis and treatment and epilepsy surgery center, I was very much on a daily basis exposed to this test. Again, the video EEG. As the term suggests, there's a video part to this test, which is a television camera, a digital camera, connected to a computer, and films are made of the patient's behavior 24 hours per day. Additionally, and simultaneously, the patient's brainwave EEG data is captured onto computer, and those two pieces of data, the video and the EEG, are the standard of care for the diagnosis of tougher cases of seizures and epilepsy. So the cases that would be appropriate for inpatient testing and analysis using video EEG would be seizures which are not controlled very well or at all with anti-epileptic drugs, unexplained syncope, which is our fancy term for fainting, and that could be a fainting spell that is due to an autonomic disorder or a cardiac disorder, atrial fibrillation that's not yet been discovered, or other cardiogenic syncope disorders. And then the term that I used earlier, which is pseudo-seizure, which has also been called psychogenic events by some authors, those are the main disorders where the video EEG is absolutely standard of care for diagnosis, and there's really no other reasonable way to make that diagnosis. And my the hospital where I have admitting privileges, and I'm on staff, Matsu Regional Medical Center has two beds, and we refer to these as epilepsy monitoring, an epilepsy monitoring unit, because we're monitoring patients with epilepsy. Okay. Now, the other...
Other questions, just some general comments about, you know, seizure medications, effectiveness of which ones are we're using nowadays.
Reasonable and important question, and I wish I had 2 hours to discuss These are really the glory days for anti-epileptic drugs. 30 years ago, we had really two drugs, maybe three, Dilantin, phenobarbital, and Mycelline. And those medications were, in fact, quite effective to suppress some seizures. They came with some side effects. Dilantin, for example, produces hyperplasia of the gums, the gums overgrowth of the gum material. There can be some bone loss with long-term Dilantin use, and this is thought to be related to vitamin D metabolism. Additionally, there's some clouding of cognitive ability with Dilantin, which patients may or may not like. The second drug, phenobarbital, works at this inhibitory GABA receptor, as I mentioned earlier, much like alcohol. It's sedating. It's addictive. It has street drug abuse potential. And if you stop phenobarbital, suddenly you could have a withdrawal. So I mentioned these are the sort of the glory days for anti-epileptic drugs. We have a list now of, in my opinion and based on my training, vastly superior medications: Keppra, Lamictal, Topamax, Lacosamide, Lyrica, Zonegran, Gabatril, Valproic Acid, and a footnote, the drug Neurontin is also FDA approved for treatment of complex partial seizures. It's a lot of neurologists don't think particularly highly of Neurontin in terms of seizure control. However, it has some excellent properties with respect to neuropathic pain. It works at the voltage-gated calcium channel. It's also been found, Neurontin has also been found in some studies to reduce cravings of addiction to the street drug methamphetamine. There's a black box warning on Neurontin related to increased suicidal thoughts. I've not experienced that problem with any of my patients, but it's out there. Neurontin actually has a rough reputation. If you go on the internet and Google on Neurontin, it gets lots of bad press. And I'm sure there are some patients that took Neurontin and had some problems with it. But for me professionally, I've had pretty good success with Neurontin as a pain control drug. Okay.
All right. In the last 5 minutes or so, let's take one of the emails. This is a email from a woman who says, I have several metabolic type smells every day. No other noticeable symptoms. I used to have 50 to 80 times per day that these metallic-like smells would occur. A neurologist she saw said that these are likely seizures and treated her as such, and the events are down to about 5 per day. Her question, do you think these are really seizures if they're not manifest in any other way?
Very interesting question. It's going to be a little difficult for me with a limited amount of information that I have to answer the question, are these really seizures? The best professional to answer that question is going to be your neurologist. And this allows me to jump back to my list of what are the important elements of the diagnosis of epilepsy, and that included the history, the physical examination, the MRI of the brain, and the EEG of the brain. Those are the workhorses for the neurologist. And I did hear in the question that the use of an anti-epileptic drug had reduced the number of these abnormal olfactory phenomena. And so that would be sort of empirical data that maybe these are seizures. But the best person to ask to clarify this diagnosis is your neurologist. They have all of the data. I only have a sort of a sketchy bit here. It's not possible to say more.
All right. JD, you're on line one.
Yes, hi. My name is J.D. I'm the president of the Holden Foundation for Epilepsy here in Alaska, and I have just wanted to bring up a couple of subjects real quick. I know we don't have a whole lot of time. One of them is involving the SUDEP, and the other one is involving the vagal nerve stimulator for treatment.
Okay, would you like Dr. Sponsor's comments on these, I suspect, huh?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm sorry, I'm trying to be as brief as possible.
That's all right. Well, we appreciate it. We'll try to take these questions real quick. The first one I didn't question. I understand the vagal nerve stimulator, and Dr. Sponsor understands the first one. Okay, thanks very much for your call.
Very good question. Number one, the question was SUDEP, which is SUDEP, and that stands for sudden unexplained death in epilepsy. The phenomenon is rare enough that I've only seen SUDEP a couple of times. The way to understand the danger in a convulsion is. This is the example I like to give. Imagine that you were holding your breath and jogging around a track for 100 yards. And that is physiologically what a person having a convulsion is having. Their breathing is not right. They may not be breathing at all, and they are exercising vigorously. That is going to increase lactic acidosis. It's going to decrease oxygen. It's going to decrease glucose. The acid-base balance of the blood is going to be altered abnormally. The brain is a selfish organ. It likes all of its metabolic parameters exactly right, or it will become irritable. Additionally, the heart similarly does not like low levels of oxygen or glucose. And so a person having a convulsion is at risk for a cardiac event, such as a heart attack. And it's not absolutely clear what happens when patients having a convulsion have sudden death. That's what the term sudden unexplained death in epilepsy means, is that a person has a convulsion and they die during that convulsion. Interestingly enough, Vladimir Lenin died from his final seizure. The second question, which I will try to answer very rapidly, was related to VNS. We may need a separate show for VNS, but it has FDA approval for adjunctive partial seizures. There's a 50% reduction in 50% of patients. It's a little electrical stimulator that stimulates the vagus nerve and physiologically is very complex, and I'll probably have to stop there.
Okay. Thanks very much for your time, Dr. Sponsor.
Thank you, Dr. Woodard.
Next week, we're going to be back, and we'll be talking with Anchorage urologist Dr. Wesley Turner. Let me just remind you, Pat Yack is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Christian Speck generously engineered today's program. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. Stroke is an emergency. Providence Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.